welcome. I appreciate the opportunity that we have to get together today. We'll try to make this as quick as possible. Obviously, we are going over the proposed statute change. I guess I would just like, it's UCA 1953, 536-211. Is there another section as well that we need to?
36107.
And 536107. And 309. 536, one, is it 1309?
Yes, 309.
Yes, 309. End of rule change. End of rule change? And rule change?
728-409.
728-409. With that, unless anybody has any questions to start off with, I will turn the TAREMP time over to counsel Linda Beatty and Mark Sciocchi for a summary.
So on this, what we've done is we've, Beatty and myself, we've looked at this and we've tried to clarify the language in the statute to prevent this the issue we had at the recent appeals, to clarify that the post council is a sanctioning body, and actually just to clean up some of the language in 107, we cleaned up some of the language that was in there that talks about post council's role as an advisor on some of these issues that was not addressed in the 2010 legislation change. And then the reason 536, 211, and 309 is one is for peace officers and one is for dispatchers.
Thanks for that clarification.
Why is Garrity crossed out and
asked that? Yeah, I did that because it wasn't
italicized.
Underlined. It was technical thing.
Very minor technical.
Right. Italic. Got it.
So because of the case name, it would be either italicized or underlined.
I was looking for spelling or something. I couldn't see anything.
On that 107, we deleted small dot I. Will that just automatically adjust from one? Now, right now it's one to three.
Yeah, so we would adjust that once we
don't have to take action. That's why I'm asking.
No, we'll fix that.
I don't want to be.
But to be clear, in the way it was written originally, you only had advisory authority over the sanction. And so this is now that you can decide the sanction.
Yeah, I'm not questioning that. I'm just questioning.
Yeah, so we would adjust that, and I appreciate that.
This is Bruce Bailey. I have a couple of questions on 728.
On the rule change? Oh, yes, and I forgot to mention the rule change. So this amends the two statutes and then the clarification on 107. And then to ensure that the rule is compliant with the statute, we made some changes on there. But, Bruce, go ahead.
So on the second page where it starts action by council, number one, where it says if the respondent waives or waived, is there a way to clean up the S and the D so it doesn't look like one word? It's misspelled.
Yes, we can clean that up. So on R-728-409-14, we'll say if the respondent waived.
Yeah, so the S is crossed out and the D was added. Yeah.
We'll make sure.
Okay, so.
Make sure it's in there.
And then going down to point four, I was just curious where it says at the council meeting the respondent and the respondent's attorney, could that be interpreted as they both must? Should it be and or?
No. So the language in that section is may.
May.
And so this corrects something that is, well, this conforms what's really been happening at council it conforms the rule to what really happened. So the rule right now permits either the respondent or the attorney and says they may address the council. Now we're saying they may both address the council, which in fact is what happens unless you think otherwise. You don't think they should both be permitted to address the council, but that seems fair and that's what's been happening.
I was just wondering if somebody could challenge that it has to be both the way it's written because it's saying the respondent and the attorney.
The word may is the word that someone who's interpreting the statutory language will look at, whether it says may or shall, and it says may.
Okay. And then on number five, four lines down, from has two Fs, where it goes respondent received from the employing agency. That's just a typo thing.
Sorry.
Say that one more time.
So it's right here. Fourth line down there, two Fs.
Yep.
On point five, if you go down where it says written information or comments concerning a respondent received from has two Fs.
Yes, got it. And these will be reviewed by an attorney or by a, someone.
By the draft, yeah.
They will be redrafted.
Yeah. And led research.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's all I had.
The rule.
No.
Well, the rule will be reviewed by our
yeah.
So the rule is probably going to hang in abeyance until statute's passed. Is that accurate?
I would believe so, yes. But we would hold on to it and try to get them around the sign at the same time, understanding the rule after the revision process.
So would you, I could very quickly go through this, the changes word by word very quickly. Would you like that? Would that be helpful?
Yeah, let's go.
Okay, let me go through it very quickly. I'll tell you that 211 and 309 are identical, except that one for this fact is one for detail. So I'll just go through 211 and 309, the same thing. Just substitute the word that is software. So the first thing that we address is letter of caution was not permitted previously in the statute, so we added that in, right? It's interesting what we caught as we went through this. The change in item D was just a grammatical issue. Gary, New Jersey, that just needs to be outside. Same with letter of caution, wasn't permitted. Letter of caution, everywhere it's added is because it wasn't in here before. Down on 4, we changed it to review because that's the word that was challenged in the appeal, the meaning of the word review, and our appellate section, Stanford, you heard, thinks that review could have a legal meaning, act as an appellate body. And I don't think that's what the rest of the sentence says, but just to avoid that challenge again, we're going to clarify it and use the word accept. Added in letter of caution, added the word decide to show that you are making a very clear decision. It's not, you're not thinking about it, you're and giving it to someone else. Is this your decision? And then
you want us to discuss concerns or wait till you finish with the document?
Yeah, let me just
okay, go ahead.
And then get come back to you. And then we get down to 6B. That's added in to address the situation. This is something we've discussed before. So suppose an agency is investigating someone, an internal investigation, and the officer decides, you know what, I'm not sticking around to find out how this turns out. I'm out of here now. I'm resigning. In some agencies, that just gets closed and it's done with. And we think that that's probably not the resolution that would be appropriate. The resolution should be, if a guy has committed a violation that's going to be investigated as an IA, it should be investigated so the next agency who hires him finds out what happened.
Isn't that already required by state law, though?
So if you look at 6A, it's required. 6A says
if
they complete the investigation and found to be true. This 6B would encompass the events where the gentleman or the officer, not gentleman, he or she, leaves the employee of the agency before the IA is complete and before you find out whether or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you're investigating me and I fail if I know I've done something wrong, and so then I go and hire with Chief Carpenter.
Well, no. I've had that happen.
What happens?
Right.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
So,
a lot
yeah,
of them
so,
don't.
We do have a lot of agencies that do report, but then we have some, unfortunately, that are not.
Okay.
This would encompass. This would catch all those.
And things. Complete seems to be open for interpretation.
So, Chief, did you have some other questions?
So, on that section, I totally agree with that section. Going back, I do have concerns, and I understand why it's there. I understand on 4A, on the bottom of 4A, where it said that we have to accept the ALJ's findings, and Director Stevenson, I spoke about this pros and cons idea behind what happens when we open Pandora's box, and we know because we've been here, we've been to the Court of Appeals over some of these, or at least in discussion as to where these will take us. However, I'm concerned because I feel like without having the ability, if we feel that there's gross deviation in our thought process versus the ALJs, and not all ALJs are attorneys. Not all of them are. They are in this case, but that is not always the case. And we obviously live in a litigious society that they're going to push back if their certification is challenged. And I recognize that, but I think the outcome the other day would have been very different had we had the opportunity to dig a little deeper. And to Director Stevenson's credit, he said, you know, we haven't looked at firearms cases very often. This was a new one for us. This was a one-off. And I guess that's my concern, is these one-offs where we really need to be able to look into that. As Chief Swanson said, those that have been involved in shootings, you have a different eye and a different view than you can ever expect an ALJ to have. And I think that I'm concerned that if that goes away, and I recognize it would, it could potentially create us other problems. I just want everyone going into this eyes open and recognize what we give up by conceding to that, I guess.
I think this
was also, oh. Sorry, this is Victoria, and I just wanted to weigh in on that because I understand I wasn't present at the meeting the other day. I got a little bit of a summary about what's taken place, but since I've been on the council, we've struggled with this in a couple of instances, and I think that it's maybe the lawyers having a different look at this than because I completely understand the concern that's being raised. I think that there's still a mechanism for deviation, notwithstanding the ALJ's rulings. And again, this is kind of looking through it through a legal lens. I think that the statute mandating that we accept the findings and fact conclusions of law, there's still the ability to essentially exercise authority outside of that matrix, outside of those guidelines. We've done it over and over again. But for both downward deviations and upward deviations. But I think the problem that we're running into is if we say, all right, here's the ALJ who's heard, who's legal trained in the case of the ALJ that Post uses, at least as far as I've been informed, that has a specific job of taking testimony, making credibility determinations, applying the applicable law. And for us, after 2 days, to say, well, we disagree with those legal conclusions. I don't understand, I guess, the basis by which we would disagree with those unless we were having an equal hearing, unless we were subjecting ourselves to 2 days of knowing the same evidence. Now, that being said, I think you can disagree with the legal determination, and the proper mechanism would be then to say, well, for all the reasons you disagree with the legal determination, you're going to treat those as either aggravating or mitigating factors. But if we get into saying that we are in a better position than a law-trained ALJ to take evidence and to apply a legal standard, I think that that's equal. I think that's the counter concern, and probably the lawyer in me talking, but I think that that's the counter concern there.
Thank you, Victoria. And I just want to point out, emphasize everything. I agree with 100% with everything Victoria said, and she said it so well and so much better than I would say it. But I want to emphasize that accepting the ALJ's findings of fact and conclusions of law does not take away your power to decide to consider aggravating and mitigating circumstances and apply those to the sanction. That is within your purview, and that's what you should do. You should listen to the arguments and should decide whether or not Post's recommendation you think is valid. But to not accept the findings of fact and conclusions of law turns you into an appellate body. Black and white, no question about it. And you're not an appellate body. And if we want you to become an appellate body, then we're going to change the statute back to the way it was in 2010. And that's a whole other matter. If you think this body should be an appellate body, then we need to start over from the beginning. But right now, it's not an appellate body. And if it's not, then you have to accept the findings of fact and conclusions of law. But you may always and should, it's your duty, to listen to the arguments, consider all the facts that you've been given, including the employer statements, supporting or not supporting the officer, and decide what the sanction should be.
Which we often do.
Yeah.
Very commonly.
Yeah.
We say, well, it's not enough or it's too much.
Yeah.
Because. And those because are either aggravating or mitigating.
Yeah.
And I think the problem is that those aggravating and mitigating factors were probably factors that give rise, that were present before the ALJ. So it's the same facts, and I think that that's why it gets a little bit confusing, is because sometimes it's the same facts. But I don't think that we are in, again, the best position of, and if, you know, there's another option or if we want to talk about this, but I don't think that this body is in the best position to be making legal determinations.
My concern, and I completely understand why we're doing this, but my concern is what we are given is basically a summary. And I feel like this prevents us from asking questions.
Because I don't know.
So does that mean that I can't ask a question to fill in the blanks? That's what concerns me.
So I think we can ask. I think that's the thing. We can ask questions. And we can ask questions about, well, what were you thinking? What was going on in your life? What else led up to that? But I think that the line is drawn, and where this draws the line is we don't get to say, well, the ALJ was wrong, right? And I don't know that we've given any individual case more than I know there's been extended discussion on it, but I don't know that we've given an individual case more than 30 minutes of kind of questioning and debate and everything like that. And I think that the argument that, okay, well, we're just given a summary, I don't think we're going to get the complete picture unless we go back and somehow review the 2 days, the 3 days of full testimony that was given before the ALJ. So I think that that concern about not having a full understanding is going to be present unless we're asking post to provide us, rather than the concise summary given by the ALJ, the entire file of all the evidence that was presented during those hearings.
And I agree with Victoria. Telling you that the law stating that you have to accept the findings of fact and conclusions of law in no way suggests that you can't ask questions.
Does it suggest that we can't look at a piece of evidence again, as in the Dunn case where a lot of people wanted to look at the video?
Yeah.
Because I subsequently looked at that video after the hearing, and I would have taken a lot different position had I had that option.
As would have
right.
I would have gone for revocation on it.
And my position was, Marcus and I are in different positions right now. Marcus
right.
is representing post-counsel. I'm representing post-investigation. Our position was, you want to see the video? We've got it ready to go, queued up and ready to go.
So, yeah, post was there to present it. But
yeah.
as this is as our law is, it would put us in an awkward.
And I respect Marcus's legal judgment.
Could we have done it, just out of curiosity from your perspective, could we have, or, and again, knowing that I wasn't present, but if should a similar event come up in the future, could we ask to review that with the understanding that, again, we're doing this in order to evaluate mitigating or aggravating factors. We're not doing it for the purpose of undermining the ALJ determination.
I like that.
If it was phrased in that way, then yeah.
I think you're
spot on. Yeah,
yes.
We could go.
I think that's the place to be.
So to kind of further answer your question, Chief Swanson, the only time the council has gone into trouble is when they've asked questions outside of what was presented in an ALJ hearing. So they introduced additional evidence for possibly another violation. Now, there have been two specific situations where that has occurred. As long as the questions are within the confines of what the ALJ found, and in the name of mitigating and aggravating, then the council can ask really any
That's
question.
Where we've got outside of the boundaries, it seems like Marcus has always pulled us back, though.
We try.
Yeah. Always that horse is out of the barn.
Excuse me. That's not really appropriate here,
I do drive, so just mine is only advice. You guys can take whatever advice I give.
Well, not too many of us.
Yeah.
You know.
But in that case, if we don't ask the question, we don't know what happened. Like somebody didn't ask, did you give a warning, a verbal warning that you were going to shoot her in the knee before you did it?
Yeah.
We didn't know that until I went home and watched the video. Also, we didn't know if she was coming at him. He kind of said that. But if you watch that video, she would just stand there.
Right. Absolutely.
She wasn't coming at him.
Absolutely.
And we didn't know that because we didn't ask.
But I did read the judge's statement on that, though, that he did evaluate that possibility.
Oh, and did say that
yeah,
he wasn't, she wasn't aggressively
right. And also,
a
yeah,
misstep or something.
Yeah.
Is what
yeah. And also, doubt that he, I believe I read the part about him saying he was going to call her.
Yeah.
And that was, in the video, that was right at the first.
Right, but
it
was confusing. That was a very lengthy, involved case. There was a lot of very complicated evidence in that case. And
including an expert.
Yeah.
They had Forsythe.
Right, and Forsythe broke that video down into second-by-second frames, and it was evaluated, and the judge made a decision based on that evidence.
Well, it wasn't clear
that I think that would have been good information for counsel as well,
yeah.
Because law enforcement at least knows Dr. Lewinsky and his work, and he has a proven track record.
Right.
So in that particular case, for me anyway, because I never want to be in a position where I'm second guessing somebody that's
right.
taking a shot. For me, where I landed was the officer that was on scene said it was not justified.
Right.
And from my perspective, he would know a lot more than what I would. I understand wanting to see for ourselves, and it sounds like we have an avenue that we could do that without just
with some
additional
jeopardizing in there.
Had the officer done that
well,
before?
Well, or is it just saying this is a mitigator? Or we consider this to be something that would help us decide whether it's a mitigating or aggravating, or mitigating or aggravator. Maybe we see that to make that decision. I think as long as it's on the record, something.
I have a question. It might be cleaner if we put it in.
I think it's cleaner.
Like rule or law?
Mm-hmm.
Either way. The rule is easier to get by than the statute.
So how about if it's amended to say, leave the language as it is, and then add in...
What are you looking at?
Oh, sorry, 4A, 4 in 5611 or 309.
Right, yeah.
And just add in a new sub B, and the new sub B, we'll have to renumber it then, would say, not however, because it never starts with however, but something along the lines of the council may request additional evidence and information heard by the ALJ. You would ask it request to review additional information and evidence.
Okay, review.
Yeah.
Marcus? I have a quick question. Do we get ourselves in trouble at all by doing that piecemeal? Like, for example, in a case where it's very voluminous like that, if we say, all right, we want to see additional evidence, we want to see the video, but then doesn't that kind of set things up where if we look at that video in a vacuum and, again, not really considering all the other things that took place during that ALJ hearing, are we opening up ourselves for a new route of litigation there?
Potentially, but I think what we have to do is just be able to articulate in the council meetings that, we've reviewed the ALJ's decision, and this is just for review. This is just, not review, sorry. I got to get
there.
The ALJ's decision, and this is, we are... looking at this evidence for mitigating and aggravating circumstances.
So procedurally, if somebody wanted to open that up, be it the request of counsel, be it the request of the respondent's attorney or the respondent him or herself, would then presenting that evidence and having that be reviewed, I assume that counsel for Post then, so Linda, would then be able to essentially kind of provide something that she viewed as counterpoints or rebuttals or things of that nature, as long as it was under the expressed provision that this is mitigating or aggravating.
Right. I see what you're saying, Victoria. This could go on forever. It can become another hearing.
It's going to be another trial, essentially.
But let me add something, which is a bit of a different perspective, because I, on that case, I just voted to accept Post recommendations. And part of it is that my perspective, I'm not an officer. So while I support that, and I think my own personal bias would be to just say, hey, officers are in hard positions, and that's definitely the perspective that I come from. But I wouldn't initially go to what I think an officer would, which is, hey, what is this like? That's your profession and you're involved so deeply that
I rested on more of a process, and I simply said, well, okay, I hear what's being said here, and I also know there's an ALJ, and how am I with, if I'm just separating myself, how am I really going to start diving into that? Because even for me, if I were to look at the video and essentially have to relitigate that in my mind, I think I just looked at it and said, you know, I can accept, you know, considering aggravating or mitigating circumstance, but it seems self-evident that there's no way that I would want to jump into retrying it in my position. I think that many of the people in that room were coming from a personal place of, hey, we want to give this officer the benefit of the doubt. And again, full disclosure, so do I. I mean, that definitely is where I come from. But I don't feel qualified to do that. I think you all do feel qualified to do that. I simply said, what the hell do I know about that? I'm just gonna look, and there's a giant stack, and I've read this whole thing, and I'm not getting into that, because I'm gonna say the process was already done here. Now it's here. I can accept aggravating and mitigating the circumstance, but I don't think we want to muddy it too much. I think it needs to be fairly simple and streamlined, and we have to have some trust in the process, or else we end up monkey wrenching the whole process. And I think that's where we have to be a little bit careful.
Question. Why is there a method or mechanism for us to know as counsel the history of the officer? Meaning prior.
Has he done this before?
Yes, because it's frustrating not to have that information.
Because isn't that generally in the decision of the ALJ?
In this case, we didn't give that, and you may have found it out subsequently, prior history. And we did not have that because it wasn't.
He made that statement himself.
I think somebody did.
But the prior shooting that he was involved in was included.
That was the deal. My question is not just that same kind of, but this officer's disciplinary history.
Talk about that.
History. Can we grandma request that? Is there a way we can have that? Because to me, that's mitigating.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a pattern that we don't even know about.
Aggravating, too.
And an example of that is Hammond.
Yeah.
I've had zero knowledge of his history. And I'm the one that motioned for the letter of caution. And then a few days later, I got hammered in the news because they had his history. Oh, yeah. They had his entire disciplinary history, and they acted like I had that information when I made that motion.
Yeah.
I didn't have it. And had I had that, it would have been a completely different outcome.
And step in, my system, of course. To get an officer's history require you to go into a closed session.
So you could request it. You could do a grammar request. We could post and dare to provide it. The closed session allows you to go in. You would go into closed session and talk about an individual character, reputation, and in this case would probably be advised to go into a closed session to talk about previous stuff that's not related to this particular case. But yeah.
How do we know that?
Do we end up then in a closed session every time? Because then essentially they're potentially raising all the good things, right? The commendations, the awards, the recognitions as essentially mitigating type of things. Do we end up putting ourselves in a closed session almost for every case?
Why does it have to be a closed session? It's public information.
It is, but so once we start getting into the past character stuff,
like employee competence,
and like that, that's, you could do an open session, but you do open yourselves up if you're talking about individuals. So if you're going into, say, Wade was a bad kid back in the day. And
ugly.
It wouldn't be fair.
It's just an American kid, right? We go back and you look back at his history. He doesn't want all that stuff because the only thing you guys are really talking about is this particular case. Does that make sense?
But it does show a pattern of.
There's a pattern of bad conduct.
I'm just saying it could open you guys up to potential issues.
I guess the issue is what concerns me is I know we want everything clean and we want everything in a nice box, but it isn't in this. And to take somebody's career without having those mitigators or, you know, those items that really weigh in on our decision, I don't want to go down this road, but at the time, there are certain times that I think we owe it to the society and the profession to, sometimes it's ugly. And that's what we have to do. I just feel that. I feel that, you know, I, as much as I want to avoid that, I think there are times that we need to look at those. And, yeah.
But I think if we say there's time, we can't pick and choose when we do that. So it's either all or none. I mean, that's part of the inherent fairness and the of the process, is that if we're going to do this, we commit to doing this every single time. Because we can't say, all right, individual A, this was kind of a weird factual situation, so we're going to do it here, but B through D on the list, you don't get that same courtesy.
Why can't the post-investigator get that information? And then if they feel that, wow, I need to take this before counsel, then they decide we're going to share the history.
So more of an aggregator.
Yes.
They've got a good feel of what this person's history
is. If they don't feel like it's relevant, then they don't bring it up.
That'd be part of their investigation.
Yeah, part of their investigation.
But
if you look at the history, the other individual does
not always report their.
Not always what?
They don't get a full work history from the department. Usually the department will just respond to a particular case.
In that case. And the pattern of conduct would almost be by
action. I'm going to post down something. I'll be there to write the investigation.
We would just stumble across it. It's not like a question, okay, what kind of employee have they been? Like an employee.
What about at least prior post-investigations?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we do report those.
Yeah, we
know. Yeah, those are in the notice of vacancy action.
Well, and if you get that rule change, sorry.
The post decides to do, you've got to respect what the chief is doing. If it hasn't risen to the point of reporting it post, or you know what?
I know what it is.
I don't think you want to be second guess either.
Dr. Checkers, did you?
Well, I just mean that what I was bringing up is that we're talking about everything is in process. We don't have to actually do anything, right? So in essence, we could just sit there and look smart because you have an investigation. The investigation is presented to us, and post already does it all. We just decide whether or not we change post recommendations, right? So in essence, if we're going to adjust upward or downward, I think it's appropriate for us to send, if we have to go into a closed session and say, hey, can we get more information before we essentially second guess what's been recommended to us? Why wouldn't we do that? So again, I get that we're in a position of being able to deviate upward or downward or change everything, and that's the purpose of it. But nonetheless, there is a process already set up for us to just step to post-counsel.
And this would have to change our investigatory process, because right now we're just looking at, can we meet our burden of proof? Now it's going to expand it to seeking out mitigators and aggravators to possibly present them to you, did you inquire? So, I mean, that doesn't sound like a lot when you're just looking at it, but when you start getting into the weeds of it, it becomes quite an added process.
We already get mitigators when we get letters from chiefs and sheriffs already. So how is this different?
Because they're feeding you the information. We would have to, that'd be another step of asking the sheriff, okay, what's in their file, their personnel file, and asking direct questions to ascertain aggravators and mitigators versus them sending us a letter because they feel inclined to do it.
Sorry, open Pandora's box.
Good question.
From an HR standpoint as well, I don't know if the chief or sheriff has to.
According to the law, it does. According to the law, says that if they've actually had.
If a violation of 15.
That's all we're concerned about, right? I mean,
well, we don't want to get
their lazy
work. But they're starting to bring up now that they want to know.
Are we talking about policy violation or activity that would?
Well, I think that's
what we're going to have to get through and say, okay, what do you have? And then we'd have to
determine
whether it fits our policy or if it fits our statute and determine whether it's a policy violation or if it violated state or federal law.
Yeah.
Then you need the apprehension of some administrator, because if there was something in the past, they would want to
see
that. And your guys' decision wouldn't necessarily be able to be influenced because the guy violated policy 4 or 5 times prior to that.
We can't even consider that.
I could see somebody
it's more of like a bench type issue that we both in.
But
Never mind. Sorry.
Chief Carpenter?
What's that?
Was there somebody
Mike,
on the...
This is Mike Graffich. Yeah. It's Mike Graffich.
Go ahead, Colonel.
Hey, so, I mean, listening to the discussion, I think it's a really good discussion, and it's right in line of what we're trying to accomplish. But you know, when you talk about other information, we are hearing other information every single time anyway, whether we're requesting it or not. Most of the people who we're taking definitive sanctions on are being represented by counsel. Counsel is representing both mitigating circumstances most of the time. A lot of times we're hearing from the officer themselves. They're presenting information. I mean, we're getting letters. We're getting, on a regular course of these, we are being exposed to more information than just simply the ALJ's findings. And so to try to say that we have to constrain all of this down to where we're doing it exactly the same way every time, I don't think is realistic, and it's not how it goes, nor I don't think there's really an expectation. If we just simply put in here that we have to, I mean, it's pretty clear that we accept the facts as presented in the ALJ findings. If we just have a sentence in there to say that we can consider totality of circumstances or other aggravating mitigating circumstances, doesn't that accomplish what we're really trying to do? Instead of, I think the more we try to statutorily paint ourselves into a corner, the more frustrated we're going to get with this.
Agreed.
We're all agreeing.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I could put a little in for it. It could just be a counsel shall accept the ALJ findings of fact and conclusion of law and the information concerning the piece, or it should be a comma. Oh, no. Yes, and the information concerning the peace officer provided by the employing agency, and consider aggravating and mitigating circumstances, and decide or to decide. What do you think of that?
To decide.
I like that.
Or to decide.
That sounds good.
Yep. Okay. That gives us enough leeway.
Okay.
Colonel, does that address your concern?
Perfectly. Linda's brilliant.
As long as possible, we can always miss something. Just the way it is. At least this gives us the opportunity.
Unlimited time lawyers can come up with a way to get around it.
Oh, yeah.
Don't worry. Because we don't ask the question.
Yeah, so. That's right. You don't know what you don't know.
Okay, are we good with that? Yeah.
Any further on that?
Let me just quickly go through the rule then.
Can I ask the question
yeah.
just really quickly?
Yeah.
So on what we're adding on subsection 6, that sub B, if I'm reading that right, I think I am, we don't have to turn over anything more than what we already have.
No.
Right.
So if I have an officer who gets arrested for DUI, reports to their supervisor and 2 days later resigns,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to have much in terms of investigation, but
okay.
would be notifying post of
mm-hmm.
the...
That would be the requirement.
Okay.
And Linda, do you need to add that additional language under 107E where you've got after accepting the findings?
Oh, yeah, under 2... Excuse me, is it 1E, right?
Exactly.
Other option is just
yep.
I think you need to accept that language in there.
Considering mitigating and aggravating circumstances.
Yeah. So the other option, Linda, is to, after the comma, after 56611, just delete. Because it says as provided in 56211, and you'd have to actually add in 536309.
So long as I read the same.
Does that make sense? So that way we're referring back to the language
for dispatchers.
So,
yeah.
Did you guys have a sponsor?
Yeah, as provided in 5360.
We have an idea.
Yeah. Everyone's good with that? Okay. Let's go to the
rule. Maybe.
So the rule, once again, you try to add in issuance of caution, issuance of a letter of caution that wasn't in there. And then mostly it was cleaning it up and referring it back to the statute. The only thing we added here is
Oh, there was a question on this regarding hearing date. So we had an issue come up when it says the next regularly scheduled meeting, and so there's a clarification on that that would we would provide 3 business days. Sorry.
Right. So this just came up again. This is another issue, a real life issue that came up with us in the last week or so, where we had a little bit of a some attorneys or when the go before the council. The statute says it must go before the next regularly scheduled court council. The attorney didn't think that was fair and violated the process. So we thought we'd
clarify it.
Well, and clarify reasonable. So you didn't have a time frame for what reasonable time is.
Yeah. So it's under 728-409-14B.
So basically, if post council meets on Wednesday, you have to have your waiver in by Friday.
Friday.
Which is reasonable. I don't know. Does anyone think that's unreasonable or should be different?
And so if not, then it would be pushed to the following council. I think that's it. It was just getting it conforming with the statute.
And, you know, actually, I already included those things that part of a mitigation in Section 5.
But it's written, we shall consider those facts. Not a rubber stamp.
Right. So you may consider the statements made by the respondent, the attorney, or his.
There's also a typo at the bottom of that.
Where is
that? So, section 21, where it says a cheaper sheriff, if you go down, it says the division within 90 days. I think you want to put an up in there.
21?
The division with 90 days of an allegation.
So it's R728-409. It's the very last paragraph.
Yes.
A chief sheriff or administrative officer.
18?
Are you
talking about?
Yeah, -18.
That's current language, right?
Yeah. Correct. So we just need a
current language.
Sorry, so show me again where it is.
Right here.
90
days.
Of.
I think someone put that already in. So, you know what I don't think I have in here, though? If you go back up to 5, the council shall accept the ALJ's findings of fact and conclusions. Well, I shall consider those findings when deciding whether a letter of caution, suspension, or revocation of sentences or based upon the ALJ finding, any written or information or comment concerning the respondent received from the employing agency, oral statements made in mitigation by the respondent or his attorney, and the post-disciplinary guidelines.
How about aggravation?
Right. That's what I'm trying to think about. But I remember my thought process at the time was, in theory, the aggravators are in the
write-up,
but maybe you have to make it a little bit clearer that that those can be.
Aggravation may come out from questioning counsel or questioning when he takes the stand.
Yeah, oral statements made in mitigation by responding to his attorney. Aggravation.
Never know.
Do we have to lock ourselves in there by some saying statements, oral statements from the employee agency?
No.
Or could we leave it more generic so that it's not necessarily locked into just those three?
So previously the rule allowed for an employer to send in a written letter, and that was generally the only thing that you guys received on the written stuff, on the written end, as far as mitigating or aggravating.
Well, that was the only thing you were required to receive, but you shall receive, you shall consider.
Before we'll start, I mean, that's up to you guys, Mike, if you want to. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, and again, I understand all the discussion and arguments about the video of the one case, but I'm not sure if that video fits within this list of factors that would allow counsel to look at that in consideration of aggravation or mitigation.
What if I just took the suggestion? Take out the parentheses, take out from oral statements made in mitigation by respondent who's returning, make that another sentence at the end and say, post may also consider
counsel.
Post counsel may also consider any aggravating or mitigating
circumstances
raised,
and coming to its decision.
Raised by post or the respondent.
I don't think you have to have raised. How about just
period?
That? Yeah.
Period. So, post counsel may also consider any aggravating and mitigating circumstances.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I'm going to take out.
Sure.
That's fine.
No, I'm good.
Maybe mitigation by responding to the attorney.
It's cleaner than right now. It's only a oral.
I mean,
yeah, and that's the problem.
I think 99% of what we get is mitigation.
Yeah.
Correct. Right. Correct.
It's rare that we get an aggravator.
And I'll tell you one reason why you don't, because I always feel constrained not to provide it because I'm very careful not to go outside what the statute allows me to present. And so
yeah.
what I believe I'm allowed to present in the past has been very strictly what you've got in your packet. And I can argue that. But other than that, I don't think I've been permitted to present any aggravator. So this would give us that opportunity.
And I think in coming to a conclusion, I think that's appropriate.
And that was it. Okay. Any other suggestions?
Any other concerns or suggestions on the phone?
Hearing none. Do we need a... We have a... How about just a motion on the packet itself? I would make a motion that the council adopt recommendations as have been amended during this meeting.
I have a motion from Spence Austin to adopt. I have a second from Director Haddon. Any further conversation? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
You need a voice vote because you're on the phone.
Yeah, we need a voice vote.
We'll go ahead for voice vote.
Noel.
Hold on. I'll call the names. Frank Budd.
Aye.
Keith Swanson.
Aye.
Keith Carpenter.
Aye.
But you're a tiebreaker.
I know. It's fine. Aye. Aye.
Our homework.
Spencer Austin.
Aye.
Dr. Checkets.
Aye.
Dr. Bailey.
Aye.
Victoria McFarland?
Aye.
Director Mike Haddon?
Aye.
Sheriff Noel?
Aye.
Colonel Ravage?
Aye.
Chief Silf?
Aye.
Okay, motion carries.
Can I make a request that we get via email a clean package with the changes highlighted in red?
Yep.
Any opposed?
Nope.
All those in favor, we're good.
No motion here.
Move.
We return.
I have a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Second from Chief Swanson. Thank you.